So, without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker. Judy Murray is a former international tennis player with an incredible 64 national titles to her name. She became Scottish national coach in 1995 and initiated the Scottish Development School programme, which ultimately produced one Fed Cup player and four Davis Cup players, including, of course, her Grand Slam winning sons, Jamie and Andy. In 2011, Judy was appointed captain of the British Fed Cup team and used this role to grow the profile and numbers in women's tennis across players and coaches. Judy has developed several well-known initiatives to encourage more women and girls to play tennis and to take the game into more rural and deprived areas, the areas where we don't see tennis being played as much as we'd like to, as much as we will. And she continues to campaign for better and more accessible facilities, including through the work of the Judy Murray Foundation. Judy, thank you.
I'm more concerned that I've just discovered that I've put my vest top on inside out. Which is a byproduct of getting up at 5 o'clock in the dark this morning to get to Heathrow to get on a flight to come up here to speak to you. So thank you very much for inviting me. I don't actually know how long I'll talk for. I'm very bad at losing track of time when I start talking. I think I'm quite a typical female. When I start talking, I often forget to stop. So you might have to stop me if I go on too long, and obviously very happy to answer questions. But I'm just going to talk you through my experience of sport, which of course has been a massive, massive part of my life. And I have sporty parents. My dad was a footballer. He played for a number of clubs, including Hibs in the early 50s, in the days when you didn't make any money from sport. And he tells great stories about how he used to line up outside the manager's door after a match and wait for his pound. And, you know, when you put that in the context of the transfer fees that you see nowadays, you know, the world has changed, the sporting world has changed. And it's changed a lot from when I was small, but I was very thankful for having sporty parents who wanted me and my brothers to enjoy sport as much as they did, and consequently played with us everything. You know, we had badminton across the washing line in the garden. We had cricket stumps. We had homemade goals that my dad made himself from wood. And what the thing I remember about my dad was he never ever let me or my brothers score past him. So it kind of transferred to when Jamie and Andy were small, I never let them beat me at tennis until they could beat me at tennis, which was probably about 12 and 13. But yeah, I was fortunate to have sporty parents. So they played with us whenever, at whatever. And as a result, we developed good sort of hand-eye and foot-eye coordination skills, which of course are the things that underpin any sport. And when I was in primary five, there was no high school in Dunblane in those days. It was a very wee village. It's a bit bigger now, but there's maybe about 3,000 people. It didn't have its own high school. Well, it did up to only about third year. And my parents decided, because I loved sport so much, to bite the bullet and send me up to Morrison's Academy. And I will be forever grateful that they were able to do that and had the foresight to do that, because the sporting opportunities at fee-paying schools are vastly better than they are at state schools. And as a result, I enjoyed playing in all sorts of team sports at school. And the reason I tell you that is that I loved being part of a team, and I think we are all products of our environment. So all the things that I enjoyed about sport ultimately became things that I put into sport when I started to coach it, which was big numbers, social, volunteers, sense of community, lots of team events. So I grew up playing, the main two sports that I played were tennis and badminton, which are quite similar in that you play them both with a racket. But when I was young, there were no coaches. There were no tennis coaches because nobody aspired to be any good at tennis. And it was not something anybody saw as being a job, because there were no jobs in tennis in those days and there were no indoor courts. So you played tennis in the summer and you played badminton in the winter. But my experience of both of those sports came first through the family and then through local community clubs, the church hall and the local tennis club, and then into the district and then into county and then to national and then into international. In tennis, you can't play tennis for Scotland. It's part of Great Britain, which in some ways in some ways is a disadvantage. I think if we were able to play tennis for Scotland, we would be able to grow more sense of identity, perhaps, up here. But we are a GB sport. So I think when Alison was saying that I won 64 national titles, that sounds unbelievable. Every time somebody says, I go, did I really? You know, when you think of it, you know, juniors in those days was just under 18s. Now it's like under 10s, under 12s, under 14s, under, you've got everything. But there were very few people to play against. And I'm telling you this from tennis was and probably still is very much a minority sport in Scotland. But back then, there were very few females playing competitively. So the competitive pool was very small. And again, for me, the product of that environment was that when there was no infrastructure, so there was a part-time national coach. So once in a blue moon, you'd get invited to Inverclyde to a training weekend. And my memories of that were great fun. Go in the train. So train from Dunblane to Queen Street, cross over Glasgow, go to Central, go to Largs, walk up the hill with your bag on your back. Great. You got away from your parents for the weekend. You're away with your pals. You're sharing a room. Love it. All the responsibility, the independence and everything. But it was the being with the other kids that was the best fun about it. But what I remember about that coach was that he had no interest in the girls. So there were two halls. There was a hall with two tennis courts, proper tennis courts. And there was an air hall, one of those sort of bubbly things with a sort of rubberized floor. And it had all sorts of equipment lying around the side of it. So you actually crashed into things all the time. And he would send the girls into this air hall. And he would come through when it was time for a break or to change an exercise and then disappear again. So I grew up with that being he has no interest in the girls. And that has formed me to be very much trying to promote the whole importance of having more women coaches, more female PE teachers in order to get more girls playing and staying in sport, because we think and act on behalf of girls, because girls is our world. We understand the changes in their emotions and the changes in their bodies. We understand how to create an environment for girls. So this whole thing of getting more girls into sport and keeping them there, for me, is very dependent on having a bigger female workforce out there. So I go through school, had a couple of really great PE teachers, female PE teachers that made all these team things happen. I was very inspired by them. And all through my high school years, I thought I was going to be a PE teacher. And in my fifth year of school, and you could leave after fifth year then when you'd done your hires, my form teacher said to me, there are no jobs in the teaching profession. It's in a mess at the moment. I advise you to go to university and do languages. So I did, after a brief foray with trying to play tennis, which was impossible at 16, 17, when your mum's looking after your younger brothers. My dad had his own business. There is nothing in Scotland whatsoever. You have to go and travel. So I travelled on my own. And this is in the days of no internet, no ATM machines, no mobile phones. You are completely disconnected and you are on your own. So you're not only having to coach yourself, you're having to look after yourself, book your travel, your accommodation, your budgeting, etc., etc. And I didn't last particularly long. But what the product of that environment for me was the lack of opportunity in Scotland. And many years later, having done my degree and then started to work, I ended up being a sales rep and a national account manager for a confectionery company, which anybody who follows me on Twitter knows I've got a bit of a sweet tooth. And just before Andy was born, we moved back from Glasgow to Dunblane, and I decided I couldn't do my job because I had to travel a lot. So two kids 15 months apart, and anybody who has kids 15 months apart is perfectly mad and knows what I'm talking about. So I gave up my job, and I found it felt very trapped being at home with two little kids. And I'd left Glasgow, so I'd left my friends, I'd left my tennis club, I'd left my job, car went with my job. So my world completely changed. So I went over and rejoined the tennis club and discovered there was still no coaches in our area all these years later. And I started to volunteer. And I wasn't a coach, I was just somebody who loved tennis, and I wanted to create opportunities for the older kids at the club. And my first success as a tennis coach was Dunblane High School boys winning the Scottish Schools Championship in 1994. It's nothing to do with my kids, but now when whenever I get asked what's your biggest success as a coach, it's the first thing that comes into my mind, because it was local, it was community, it was just a bunch of kids from the club who were, none of them were superstars, but collectively they were a great team. So it kind of was representative of everything that I'd experienced in sport coming through. So I spent several years building things up at the club, and like most volunteers, you know, the more you do, the more people expect you to do. And with two young kids, I couldn't do everything. So I thought, okay, happy to do the coaching. So I need an army. And who do I bring in? I bring in all the mums. Because who wants things to happen more for their kids than the parents? And it's the mums who are, by and large, are the ones who are around. So I had mums running a cafe, I had mums running competitions, I had mums running, writing things for the local paper and the school newsletter and organising matches. So I started my own army at the club. So I built things up at the club, and then I started to move into the wider local area. Still no indoor courts, so school halls during the winter, in the days when you used to be able to go and pick up a key from a Janny and open the school, the sports centre, and go in. And they weren't proper tennis courts. They were shiny floors, lines everywhere, take your racket back, you hit the wall. But I got good at catering for big numbers of kids in any old space that I could find. And my message from that is always, it's not what you have, it's what you do with what you have. And I kept 66 kids playing through the winter because of those school halls once a week on a Sunday evening, or a Sunday practically all day. So I moved from working in the local area to realizing that a lot of the kids that I was working with were getting really good, and that I didn't know enough about coaching. I mean, all these things like Western grips and topspin serves and double-handed backhands, I learned with a wooden racket. You know, I step in and you swing through over your shoulder, and that just wasn't holding up in modern tennis. So I went and upgraded my coaching qualification. I'd done a qualification before I went to university as a means of making some pocket money, and never used it. But it allowed me to go to the second stage of qualification, which was a week-long course. So I did that. And at the end of it, it didn't give me what I wanted. It gave me a lot of information, and it didn't give me anything I didn't really know. But what I needed it to give me was, how do you practically apply all this stuff that you've learned? And actually, the best way to learn is to work alongside somebody who's great at what they do, who organises well, communicates well, plans well, delivers well, and is experienced. And there was nobody to learn from. There was just nobody was doing player development as a thing in Scotland. So everything that I had to learn as a tennis coach, I had to learn by myself and for myself. And about a year and a half after I did that course, I applied to do another one because I had a lot of good kids, and I needed to invest in myself, to invest in them. So I applied for a course that was a year long. So it was all sort of three-day workshops that I crossed the course of 12 months, and they were all down south. And it was the first year of it. It's called a Performance Coach Award, and the LTA had been planning it for about 4 years. And I applied for it, and I didn't expect to get a place on it, but I did. And when I got there on the first workshop, which is in Basingstoke, what I realised was, I felt like I was completely out of my depth. I felt, coming from Scotland, much more time commitment for me, much more financial commitment for me, because I'm so far away from it as much as anything. But I get there and there's 18 men and 2 women. And of the 20, there are 19 full-time coaches who all work in big, posh clubs with indoor courts. And I'm a volunteer in Dunblane. So I felt completely out of my depth as a female. And as a Scot probably as well. And I really thought about, have I done the right thing here? And then one of the tutors said to me, welcome to the course. So you're very lucky to have a place on this course. And I said, yes, I know, thank you. I'm looking forward to getting started. And he said, yeah, we had to turn a lot of guys away. And I went, right, okay. And then I thought, I mean, one of the biggest things for me learning to coach is your ability to make people feel good about themselves is absolutely crucial, because you can get a change in anybody's behavior or performance if they feel good about themselves. And if they don't feel good about themselves, if you make kids, well, or adults, feel bad, or they don't belong, or they're not any good, or they've made a mistake, you know, you're really wasting your time. So I just looked at this guy with my best death stare. And he said, he said, we actually had an official complaint from someone who we turned down about you getting a place on the course. And I said, really? And he just carried on. And he said, yeah, he said, what could you possibly offer to performance coaching when you have two kids? So I looked at him, and then I went away, and I kind of sat and sulked a bit for about an hour, and I thought, oh God, whatever. And then I just went into you mode. And that has served me very, very well over many years of being a woman working in a man's world. And I thought, I'm here, I've paid for it, I'm going to get on with it. And I did it. I passed the course. I didn't pass the course because I was a good coach. I passed the course because I was clever, because it was information based again. It was all lectures. And what I wanted was to watch great coaches. I wanted to see what they did and how they did it on a day-to-day basis, because all I wanted to do was create opportunities for the kids that I was working with. And I didn't get it there either. And again, that has formed me as a coach and a coach of coaches, or a teacher of teachers, is that I do everything with my audience, and then I bring a class in and I show them a class in action. So I put myself in front of classes of kids or adults that I don't know, never seen before, and I show them, here's what a session looks like, because that's the best way to learn. So much I learned about coaching and teaching others came from actually from bad experiences. But if you think about life, we always learn more from our failures and our defeats and our mistakes and things that go wrong. So I finished that course, I pass it, and three things happened for me. One was getting a place on that course, and the head of coach education at the LTA was a woman. She gave me the place on that course. As a result of passing the course, I got the chance to work with British under 12s and under 14s national girls teams. So that allowed me to travel to other countries. That was offered me by a female captain. And that experience of being able to go abroad and learn from other coaches who'd been there and done it for years, travel, awareness of standards, the international circuit, that gave me all the learning that I wanted to be able to help the Scottish kids. And the third thing that happened was that the Scotland applied for a national coach. They had a vacant position for about 18 months, and nobody wanted that job. And the reason that nobody wanted that job was we had no track record. We had no home. We had no national centre. We had no international workforce. We had no infrastructure. So nobody from another country with any pedigree or track record is going to apply for that job, because there's literally nothing there. So who's going to apply for that job? Me. And I wasn't going to, but it was a woman. It was the woman who was the Secretary of Tennis Scotland at the time. She persuaded me to apply for that job. And she said, you can do it. You've got the passion to do it. And that's another thing, product of your environment. Passion underpins everything, absolutely everything. Passion can trump experience a lot of the time. So I became the Scottish National Coach. I started with a £25,000 salary, a £90,000 budget. The indoor courts at Stirling University had literally just opened. That was it for the whole of Scotland, four courts at Stirling University. So I realised I had to start small. So I started small. I started with 20 children that I thought had the most potential across Scotland, aged between 7 and 11. Andy was the youngest. Elena Baltasha was the oldest. And I started just on weekends, and then I started to grow it and grow it. And as Alison said, we got four Davis Cup players and a Fed Cup player out of that. But as I went on, I realised I can't do it on my own. I had my hopper of balls, my block booking at Stirling University, and I brought the parents in. I brought the parents in to help me look after other kids, put them up overnight, do car shares, do tournaments down south, et cetera, et cetera. And then I realised I had to build a workforce, because I can't do all the coaching myself. I can't do all the travelling myself. And I got money from Sport Scotland for a performance coach development programme. And it was £10,000 a year. And they gave me it for six successive years. And I used that money to bring in people from other countries, because there was nobody to learn from up here. There was no tennis expertise in Scotland at all. I brought in physical trainers, physios, mental skills experts. And I didn't just bring them in for one-offs, because one-offs don't work. You need to bring them in for two or three days at a time, three times a year, to create relationships. If you create relationships with people, not just on a coach-to-coach relationship, but with our players, then we have a chance to make something happen. And this is just all doing that. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was going on common sense, and I was going on my things that I had experienced and knew what worked and or what I thought worked and what didn't work. And as a result of that program, we got a number of coaches who went on to be experts in their field in British tennis. And one of them is, she's not anymore, but she was coach to Gordon Reid, who's a world number one wheelchair player at the end of 2016. And she headed up British Tennis Disability Department, which is a huge job. And the other one who you'll have heard of is Leon Smith, who is head of men's tennis and the British Davis Cup captain. And he started with me when he was 20, Karen when she was 22. So I became the Fed Cup captain, which is the British women's team. So actually, out of our little cottage industry of literally nothing, we created some great players and we created some great coaches. So I'm a huge believer in investing in people and bringing people together and community and making things happen. So that's kind of my coaching thing. I left the Scottish National Coach job after 10 years because there wasn't, I needed more support for the players. We had so many that were world class and I needed money for them to train in other countries because we didn't have an environment for them. And nobody was willing to give me that extra money. So that's Sport Scotland. I got used to having hands put in my face and doors shut on me. And I think partly it was because tennis was a minority sport. It wasn't really something that we did. I think a lot of it was because I was a female. And I think part of it was because I was a parent of two of the players. So I thought, right, okay, Andy had just won the US Open Juniors. How good is that? 10 years after you started with nothing, you've got a junior Grand Slam champion from Scotland. And I was like on cloud nine, went and made a presentation to Sport Scotland and they basically said, no, no more money. We're not interested in junior Grand Slam champions. We're interested in Grand Slam champions. And it was at that point that I realized that I was wasting my time. So I left and I decided I was going to just give my kids the best chance that I could possibly give them. It was a big risk for me because I'm giving up a job. Car came with a job. Where's the money going to come from? But I had to believe that Andy winning that would attract some sponsorship. And so we were hand to mouth for a long, long time. And anyway, the boys did what they did. Jamie finished, Andy trained in Barcelona from 15. Jamie trained in Paris after he finished school. The biggest challenge was getting the money together to pay for all of that because we had nothing here and we still have nothing here, which is a huge source of disappointment to me that we haven't been able to capitalise on everything that's been achieved and the excitement and the profile. So anyway, the boys have done what they've done. You'll have read all about everything that they've done. And they've really been quite remarkable, incredibly resilient, incredible hard workers, great role models, and have remained really humble and grounded despite the world in which they live and in which it's very easy to get carried away. And about 5-6 years ago, I realised that there was a very good chance that there would be no legacy from what they had achieved because nobody appeared to be really taking hold of this tennis thing up here. We had very weak leadership in Tennis Scotland for many years through those sort of golden years. And so I started a programme called Tennis on the Road, which was basically a van full of equipment and myself and another coach. We work 50 days a year and we take tennis into mainly rural and disadvantaged areas and we build workforces in local communities. So we teach people how to teach tennis. So whether they're parents or teachers or students or youth leaders or community workers, club members, because we don't have a big enough workforce. And if you don't have people delivering activity, you ain't going to grow the game and capitalise on the excitement. The other part of that puzzle, of course, is more public courts, more courts in state schools. But my bit is I can grow the workforce. I can hopefully share all that enthusiasm and experience that I have to get more people getting others started. So Tennis on the Road has now become my foundation over the last 18 months. So I put all my own money into the foundation to set it up. And that's basically what we do, deprived in rural areas. My experience from Fed Cup was how much harder it is to make things happen on the women's side of the game. I learned that probably in the first week of Fed Cup when I was arguing to get a video analyst to come with us so that I could video the opposition playing so that we could, you know, just what I'd always done with the boys' tennis. You video who you're playing next, you analyse it, you set the strategy and off you go. And it's every step of the way of their careers has been learning what's next, what's the next stage, what do we need to do in the next year. Just having to learn, having to find the right people, the right environments, the right places, because there is no book that tells you what to do. And there is nobody, everybody's path is different. But you have to learn, first I had to learn to coach, then I had to learn to manage the junior and then the transition circuit into the men's. Then you're managing teams of people. You're managing teams of tennis and physical trainers. And you're also managing a business site. You know, I mean, I learned how to do tax returns in four different countries, I'll have you know. Because, you know, if you can't afford to pay people to do these things, you have to learn it for yourself. So over the years, the teams got bigger and bigger because Andy was successful. But you can start to invest that money in the right people to make the whole thing work. But when I did Fed Cup, I got really into the women's side of things because I asked for a video analyst to go to the Fed Cup with us. I had myself, a physio, a fitness trainer, and a team manager. And I wanted a video analyst because I wanted to do it properly. And at that time, we were in an obscure zone in Israel, and nobody came to watch us. There was no media. And I was fighting tooth and nail for this video analyst to do it properly. And I said, excuse me, I'm asking for a fourth member of our team. And they said, oh, you know, you've already got three and yourself and whatever. And I said, I know, but I'm trying to build a team here. I want us to be successful. I want to take a video analyst with us. And at the last Davis Cup that I was at, there were 19 people on the bench. So, you know, you have to fight. You have to fight all the time on the women's side. And now look at our Fed Cup. Look at us. You know, we're in the world group now. And I mean, it's just, you know, we developed players, we created profile because we had no media with us. We did social media. We did all the dresses and the Hello magazine and the Daily Mail thing. We created our own profile ourselves because no media came to watch us. And, you know, 5-6 years later, we're in a great place. But that led me to starting a program that's aimed at getting more girls into the game. We have four times as many boys coming into tennis as girls, called Miss Hits for age 5 to 8. Great, fun, girl-friendly program that attracts female coaches or mums or students to get involved in delivery. And then I started another program called She Rallies, which is all about building a bigger and stronger female workforce across the UK. So I started it with a female-only conference, 120 female tennis coaches at it, and then 26 part-time ambassadors that I trained up over 2 days, and then they go out into their patches and they grow their own armies, just like I did at the tennis club. You bring in the women in your area and you train them up, and you start to grow things that way. I started with 26 ambassadors. I've now got 50, coming to the end of my third year of it, and that will be enough for me, ready to pass it on to somebody else. Because one of the biggest things I learned is the importance of a succession plan. I created a succession plan in Scotland with Karen and Leon and some of the others that came through. I tried to create it at the club, but actually when I left the club, everything fell very quickly. You take a key person out, there's no succession plan. It's amazing how quickly things can fall apart. So my final project is to try and get the Murray Tennis Centre off the ground just outside Dunblane, and to be a community focused, of course, family friendly, of course, these are our things, and to work use it as a national workforce development centre for tennis in Scotland. So people can come to me wherever they work, whatever they do, whatever level, and I can share that 30 years of experience that I've got to build the workforce, because that's where our strength will be in the future, is in our people. And if we don't do that, we won't capitalise and we won't have leverage when Jamie and Andy stop playing. So it needs to be done now. And I think that's enough.